The committee will come to order for a meeting of the Capital Investment Committee. Members, buckle up. You ready to go? There is a quorum present, and so I would like I know that Representative Miller has been studying these minutes of February 28th.
Mr. Chair, I've been anxiously awaiting to approve the minutes. I move to approve the minutes of our last meeting.
Representative Miller moves to approve the minutes of the last meeting. Representative Dean, is there a second?
Sure, I'll second.
Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The minutes are approved. Thank you very much. Today, we have several overviews we're going to do. We don't have these bills in our possession, but we will be overviewing the Minnesota Housing Project request, also Minnesota Pollution Control Agency with a couple of landfill issues, and finally the Military Affairs Bonding Request overview. So that is what we'll be doing. We'll be trying to roll right along here today and begin, as I said, with an overview of the Minnesota Housing Bonding Request. We have testifiers at the table before us. Welcome to the committee, ladies. Would you please identify yourselves and begin your presentation?
Good afternoon, Chair Erdahl, Vice Chair Uglum, Representative Hostman, and members of the committee. My name is Allison Strike, and I'm the Deputy Director for Carver County Community Development Agency and one of the Homes for All co-chairs. My co-chair, Senta Lepp, who is the Executive Director for the Minnesota Coalition for the Homeless, is testifying right now in the Senate in support of the Homes for All bonding bill. Homes for All is a statewide coalition of more than 200 organizations providing housing and supportive services in all of your districts. Our success as a coalition comes from a shared support in statewide investments in the full continuum of housing, because where we live impacts every aspect of our lives. On behalf of the entire coalition and the 850 advocates who registered for Homeless Day on the Hill, I want to thank the committee for hearing our bonding request, House File 3125. An investment of $140 million in bonds would develop or preserve housing for 4,650 households across Minnesota. Additionally, this bill will expand eligible uses to help house seniors and save manufactured home parks. Again, I want to thank you so much for your time today. I look forward to any questions that you might have. And with that, I will turn it over to one of our other Homes for All Coalition members.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself.
Thank you. Chair Erdahl, Vice Chair Uglin, Representative Hausman, and all members of the committee, thanks for having me here today. My name is Deidre Schmidt. I am President and CEO at Common Bond Communities. Thanks for the opportunity to address you. Common Bond provides housing and services to thousands of Minnesotans, many in your districts. We serve both Greater Minnesota as well as the metro area. We develop, own, manage, and offer services in over 5,700 units, and we serve over 9,500 people. We believe that a home is the foundation for everything else in life. We provide services that help folks living in our housing units achieve their highest and best life and get in a position where they can give back to communities. And a couple of examples from our program work in the last year, we helped achieve 100% graduation rate among the high school participants in our teen programs. We prevented 371 evictions, and we supported 1,200 Common Bond residents in taking active leadership positions in their communities. And I know that these are successes are possible only because those folks had stable and affordable housing. Using housing infrastructure bonds, Common Bond has been able to develop or preserve 4 projects delivering 663 units and helping almost 1,200 people. So in Ramsey, Minnesota, the existence of housing infrastructure bonds meant that 47 families were able to find permanent affordable housing and access supportive services, including job training, at Common Bond's Sunwood Village community. Sunwood Village and nearly 50 other projects across the state would not be possible without housing infrastructure bonds. Housing infrastructure bonds are one of the few flexible tools that we have available to us to preserve and build new supportive housing for some of Minnesota's most vulnerable populations. When I look ahead into Common Bond's pipeline, I can tell you that if we have the financial resources necessary, we right now have 9 projects ourselves that we could move forward with. And the Homes for All Coalition is aware of almost 90 more planned developments. And that survey doesn't even take into account the expansion to 2 new eligible uses or the participation of community land trusts. $140 million in bonding would invest in over 4,600 households across Minnesota. It would help stabilize numerous communities. It would create 2,000 Minnesota jobs working directly on housing projects. And it would maintain the flow of federal resources and private investment into these developments. In addition to the financial leverage that we're talking about, housing infrastructure bonds triggering, I think it also provides leverage of the human capacity in our developments. Thanks in large part to their access to stable, affordable housing, residents of Sunwood Village and all Common Bond communities are contributors in their home communities. They volunteer with their faith organizations. They work in jobs that are critical to our economy as home health aides or in school cafeterias. We also have senior residents, many of whom have extremely low fixed incomes and virtually no assets. But make no mistake, they are too active in their communities, in their own families. And many of our residents are here today on the Hill, challenging the very stereotype that renters are not interested in community, that they don't give back, and that they're not interested in public policy. Take, for example, a resident at Upper Post Vets community who went from homelessness and chemical dependency to a happy marriage and numerous volunteer athletic coaching roles, or one of our own employees who grew up at a Common Bond community and is now a career advisor to others as they seek their highest possible employment and how to ladder their careers. I really urge you to listen to their thoughts about the incredible impact that housing infrastructure bonds have had on their lives. Thank you for your time, and I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you, and I do have a couple, Ms. Schmidt. The units that are built, how many do they house generally? How big are they?
It's important to remember that housing infrastructure bonds do 2 things. They allow the new construction of supportive housing units and the preservation of existing affordable housing units. And so there's such a wide variety of housing stock, some of which is quite old. I can give you an example from here in St. Paul of a tower called Skyline, which has a variety of efficiency up through 2-bedroom units. And then you saw pictures of the new construction product in Ramsey, which is a more modern interpretation of what our expectations are for quality affordable housing.
Okay, thank you. Excuse me, Representative Juergens, you have a question? Would you want Ms. Schmidt back?
Yes, Ms. Schmidt, please. Just a question with housing infrastructure bonds, is there a component then tied to federal funding? And if there is, could you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure.
Ms. Schmidt.
One of the features of the housing infrastructure bonds is that it allows folks working on affordable housing in this state to leverage resources that might not otherwise come here, if you see what I mean. By use of the housing infrastructure bonds, are able to unlock federally supported resources as well as private investor dollars And the estimates I've seen is that that leverage basically is about a 1-to-4 ratio. And it's important to note that specifically with regard to preservation, oftentimes we're preserving not just the physical asset, but we might also be preserving a flow of rent subsidies that really that come from the federal government that might otherwise go away and never return to this state. So the preservation and the leverage, if you think about it that way, is really twofold. It's in the investment in the physical structure, but it's also in the in these rent subsidy resources that make it possible for us to house folks that have the highest needs.
Representative Juergens.
So for $140 million in the housing infrastructure bonds, we might, with a 4-to-1 ratio, we might see $500 million worth of investment both between federal dollars and private investments.
Yeah, absolutely. There would be a range, again, depending on how much of that gets allocated to preservation versus new construction. You know, so I'd hate to commit to a specific number, but it is in that hundreds of million dollar range, definitely.
Thank you.
Representative Poston.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You've talked a little bit about jobs, and you've talked about the federal matching. If Minnesota, if we didn't do infrastructure bonds, what else would we lose by not doing them?
Yeah. Ms. Schmidt.
Housing infrastructure bonds are a really unique tool, and most states don't have them. And I can tell you, since we work outside of the state of Minnesota as well, their outcomes are very different. They are less able to preserve both the physical assets and the streams of rent subsidies, and they're not able to leverage this federal investment and private investment in other ways. In fact, I was on a panel last week at a national conference about preservation, and time after time we heard state housing finance agency representatives and developers in those states saying, we wish that we could unlock these resources in the same way that the housing infrastructure bond allows Minnesota to unlock those resources.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Ms. Schmidt.
Good afternoon, Chair Erdahl, Vice Chair Uglum, Representative Hausman, and members of the committee. My name is Sean McElhattan. I'm the Senior Development Director with North Country Cooperative Foundation, or NCF. NCF is a nonprofit organization, and our primary work is to organize residents of manufactured home parks and help them buy and operate their parks. We provide technical assistance to the residents to do everything from organize, you know, a governmental structure to carry out infrastructure improvements in the park. I'm here today as a member of the Homes for All Coalition in support of House File 3125, which would expand the use of housing infrastructure bonds to include manufactured home parks. As others have already stated, an investment of $140 million in bonds would make a significant impact in meeting the affordable housing needs of Minnesota families and would be a tool to solve the infrastructure needs of manufactured home parks. As you may know, there are over 50,000 Minnesota families that own their homes because manufactured housing is such an affordable option. But we're in the state of Minnesota, we're losing an average of three manufactured home parks a year. Most Minnesota manufactured home parks were developed 30 to 50 years ago and have private infrastructure systems that are at or beyond their anticipated useful lives. Last year alone, over 200 units of manufactured housing were lost because there were limited financial resources available to residents to complete infrastructure improvements that would save those parks. NCF has helped eight manufactured home communities in the state of Minnesota organize and buy out their parks, including Hillcrest Community Cooperative in Clutch Grove, Minnesota, where 90 households were able to save their homes and preserve their communities. Members of this committee, Representatives Gunther, Bennett, and Salk, each has a resident-owned park in his or her district that was aided by NCF. We're committed to helping more Minnesotans maintain this affordable ownership opportunity. On behalf of manufactured home parks all across the state, I want to thank you for your time, and I'm happy to answer any questions you might have. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hello, my name is Crystal Norcross. Thank you for having me here, Chairman, Vice Chairman, House Committee. Today I'm here to talk about my experience. Less than a month ago, I was homeless with two children. I was homeless for 6 months, and that was not my first time being homeless. I was homeless twice as an adult. And I grew up with my grandmother, who raised me since I was born. I didn't have parents. But anyways, a bill like this could mean so much to so many people throughout the state, throughout here. You know, as an American Indian woman, seeing something like this could help so much in a small community like the American Indian community. I've been a part of Andi Young, who's had a huge impact on my life. Andi Young is a shelter for Native American youth, as well as everybody else, but specifically Native American youth who are runaways or homeless. And I think a bill like this to go through would really, really help make an impact on our communities. So today I come here asking with an open heart that you please, please, please pass House File 3125. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
My name is Carrie Johnson. I'm with the Homes for All Coalition, and I am just in charge of the slides. So,
thank you. I just, wondering. You've got a very
welcome
fine.
Welcome. Any other questions that you may have? Though
you've done a very fine job so far.
Thank you.
Maybe you could answer a question or two. How many homeless are there in Minnesota? And I would imagine that figure varies from month to month, year to year, whatever, but do you have an estimate?
It definitely varies on every night, and I definitely know one figure that stands out in my mind is that on any given night there are roughly 9,500 homeless children across the state of Minnesota. That means they're not able to go to schools on a stable basis. That means they're not getting the education that they need. That means they might not be getting the food that they need because they go to school to get meals. Something that is really passionate, for a lot of the people in this room, solving that problem would be very helpful and in help with a $140 million bond bill.
Well, I think it's, very, admirable work that is being done to try to basically help these children. Do we know how many adults are homeless?
I don't have those figures off the top of my head. I more work on the development side and represent community developers. But we can, is there somebody in the room that can maybe speak to that?
If anyone knows that, they could testify or tell us something. Well, here comes someone that may know.
Chair, and all members of the committee, I'm Ryan Baumtrag. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for Policy at Minnesota Housing. So I believe the question was how many homeless people are there in the state. We do, HUD requires an annual count every year, and in the past year, in 2017, that showed that 7,600 Minnesotans across the state were homeless. We know that that number is on the low end. That's one day in January. We know that throughout the year it's probably upwards of 15,000 that experience homelessness. And of that amount, about 35% are children and the rest are adults.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Any other questions? Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I too wanted to thank you for having this hearing today. This is the Homes for All Day on the Hill, and they made the request to have the testifiers while they're here. I think there are some in the room, and there's some in an overflow room somewhere. And actually, to that group, I owe them all an apology because I was supposed to be at 9 o'clock this morning at Central Presbyterian where they were all gathering over 700, and I was stuck not yet having my driveway and streets cleared, and so I am really regretfully missed that. But we know that these kinds of challenges that they've talked about are all over the state, and as a result, I think the support for this has been bipartisan. I mean, it is just broadly understood and appreciated. And the success we've had in the last few years, I think, is attributable to the coalition that's formed around this, the Homes for All Coalition. I've never seen an advocacy group quite so consistently organized around this. She mentioned 200 groups around the state. I should add just a point about housing infrastructure bonds and how we partner, and to use Ms. Schmidt from Common Bond, who testified earlier, as the prime example of success. When we do the construction or renovation, those groups that we partner with housing infrastructure bonds, Lutheran Social Service, Catholic Charities, Common Bond, Beacon, Aon, Common Bond, I believe is the largest in the Midwest, they have to prove to us that they have all the permanent supportive services around that, because we know from experience that that's what brings lives to a better place. And I always use the high rise that she referenced on 94 as the example, Skyline Tower, who before they managed it, those teachers in St. Paul who had students coming for that building always knew there were children there who were going to have challenges in the classroom. And then Common Bond took over the management of it, and they built a building out front where they, among other things, did early childhood education and after-school tutoring, and now 92% of the young people in that building graduate from high school. So that idea of partnering with nonprofits, and they provide those services, the goal is to really bring residents there to a better place in life, because nothing else in life goes very well if you don't have a safe place to sleep at night. So the work that they do, Homes for All, we know that seniors, that growing number of those who are homeless, families who have jobs but can't find an affordable place, with incomes flat and rents rising, families and seniors are caught in this as well. And the work of Homes for All is part of what helps us have the courage to be aggressive in our funding of it. And they're here in numbers today.
First, I'd like to thank Representative Hausman. If the public, the members don't know, she has been a tireless advocate for affordable housing in both her service in the minority and in the majority. So folks should be aware of that. Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, just a follow-up when you were asking about the number of people, both young people and adults. Could anybody share with us what the total need is? I've heard two numbers in the last couple of weeks. One was that the total need was about $600 million. I was at a meeting at a parish up my way the other day, and the number was used of $1 billion. And I'm just curious what that total need is. There's one way to look at it from the standpoint of the number of people served or a need, and then there's what the total financial need is if we were to ultimately, and hopefully we will get there at some point, to meet the total need. Anybody know that number?
I would like to invite Ryan back up from Minnesota Housing.
I'm just curious because it was a $400 million swing before two different groups. One group, 400, the other group, a billion.
I assume you're referring to the dollars needed for affordable housing to accommodate.
Mr. Chair, welcome back.
Good to see you again.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Representative Carlson, you know, I don't have that number off the top of my head. I know Ms. Schmidt talked about her pipeline and the need. I can speak to the need that we see at Minnesota Housing as communities identify their needs for homelessness and as they apply with developers to this resource. We're turning away about three projects for every one that we fund. So there isn't, I don't know the end, but I certainly know that there are many communities on a year-to-year basis that have identified serving people experiencing homelessness as a high priority and not enough resources to meet that need. The issue of homelessness is a solvable one, but it's also a moving one that is impacted by the market. So it's a moving number, but we certainly know right now we don't have enough resources to meet the needs for those experiencing homelessness.
Representative, if I might just add on to that as well. As Ms. Schmidt mentioned in her testimony, that through the affordable housing developers that are part of the Homes for All Coalition, we do know of 89 planned projects that could be ready to move forward if the right financing was available. That would equate to about 3,800 units of affordable housing, permanent affordable housing.
Okay. Apparently nobody present knows what that number is, but being that there was that wide swing, I was just interested in what it might be ultimately in terms of what we need to do in the end. I'm familiar with what the request is here today. I was just going to comment. I picked up on something that Representative Hausman said. Like you, I'm a retired teacher, Mr. Chairman, and when I retired, I was asked by more than one individual, gee, how has teaching changed? In my case, it was 33 years in the classroom. And I said, the mobility of the students. When I started teaching, I would have, in the course of a year, a few students that might have moved. And it was typically maybe a job transfer or maybe they bought, I was teaching in Minneapolis, a home in the suburbs. But there were not very many students in the course of a year that moved. When I retired, students were in and out and back in large numbers, and they were constantly, many of them, off balance educationally. In my case, when I retired, I was at Edison High School in Northeast Minneapolis, and what I'm talking about, a student might have been enrolled at Edison for a month. The next month, they might have been up at Fridley or Columbia Heights or maybe in another Minneapolis school, and then they'd be back at Edison a few weeks later. You'd find out that maybe they had the resources initially to provide housing for a short period of time, and then they no longer, for one reason or another, had the resources, and so they would maybe move in with a family member. I do remember just before I retired, a young woman very close to graduation, and I was teaching mostly seniors, came up to my classroom, and she was checking out. And I said, oh, where are you going to be going to school? She was a few weeks from graduation. And she said, oh, I'm not. My dad lost his job. We're living in the car. And right away I got a hold of the school social worker, and some help was made available. But she was about ready to literally drop out on the eve of graduation. And I just point out that is a major issue, not only in the value of providing stable housing, but how it impacts in so many other ways. And in my case, my teaching profession was greatly impacted by that that mobility. I had a young woman in class that every 2 weeks she was moved from one housing situation to another. And so every third two-week period, and that was an arrangement that had been worked out apparently among family members. But she would be at a Minneapolis school 2 weeks. She was at a St. Paul school 2 weeks, another Minneapolis school the third go-around, and then back to the building that I was teaching in for the next rotation. And the bottom line was a housing situation, and she was a young woman that needed a place to stay, and the family had worked out that kind of an arrangement. So this is a big, big issue when we talk about housing stability and what the impact is really across all kinds of jurisdictions of state government.
And, well, thank you, Representative Carlson. I'll come to you in just a second, Representative Hausman. But, you know, as I'm listening to this, again, appreciative of the great work being done by, these organizations, the homeless, but I'm also reminded that, sometimes they're just individual people that step up and help. My teacher's son and his wife became aware of two young girls who were sleeping in a car at night. That was their home. And he invited them into his house for basically their senior year in high school. So every now and then that happens too. Too bad there isn't maybe more of it. Representative Halsman.
Mr. Chair, I was just going to add to Representative Carlson's that University of Minnesota did research on exactly the impact of what he's talking about, and they found that by the time a child reaches the fifth grade, if they have been homeless or highly mobile, they're achieving at the level of a second grader who's been in stable housing. So the contributing factor that a stable place to live has on academic achievement.
Okay. Thank you. I guess if you have nothing else, whoops. I'm sorry, we have Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering just a couple things. Does the money that you're talking about, the housing infrastructure bonds, does that build shelters? Does it build transitional housing? Could you just list off the different types of housing that gets, you know, built or preserved?
Sure. Representative, the answer to that question is it's permanent supportive housing. So there are other programs that fund and help address a person's need where they might be shorter-term rental housing, but the housing that we build with housing infrastructure bonds is permanent supportive housing. And so they are able to stay there and receive the services that they need or the education, get the degree they need, but they are there until they're able to move on to other stable housing. So it's permanent. It's not transitional housing or shelters.
Representative, I'd just like to add on that supportive services not only encompasses sometimes working with a case manager, but also can include things like Deidre Schmidt mentioned, which could be job training services, team programs to make sure that people are set up for success to be able to get back involved in their communities as well.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then I guess you mentioned something like 150 organizations or 200 organizations that are involved in this area. Is there a list available of those? And are they, you know, geographic? I mean, seems like a lot of organizations. And
thank you for that.
Are they all receiving state funding?
Thank you for that question, Representative. There are over 200 organizations that have endorsed the Homes for All agenda this year. They are representative of the entire state. Every county and organization would work in or represent or work with those counties. There is a list, and we can make that available to you as well as all of the committee members. And they work in different facets of housing. Some provide supportive services only. Some are able to provide shelters, and some do actually build affordable housing.
Thank you very much. Mr. Chair, that would be helpful if we could each have a list.
All right, thank you. One more question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just for the committee, I just was checking on the number of homeless in terms of our veterans population. I know our commissioner, Veterans Affairs, has been working on this for several years now. And right now, the last count that we had, according to the Minnesota Post article, was 317. So we've really reduced the number of veterans that are homeless in Minnesota. So, and that we can give that a lot of that credit to the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. So.
Continue, please.
If I can just add to that point, there was a statewide plan that 11 state agencies and then private and other public institutions joined in. One of the notes that we highlighted is since 2010, the veterans homelessness population has gone down 56%. And it's a population that we're working with the Department of Veterans Affairs to identify on a person-by-person basis in each county of the vets that are homelessness, that are experiencing homelessness right now, and coordinating their access to care and housing.
I believe a new structure was opened in Minneapolis this summer for veterans housing.
And then also through housing infrastructure bonds, I believe we funded three or maybe four projects that exist on VA property. Mm-hmm. And so they're able to get housing stability through the state resources, and then they're able to have access to their health care in short order.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, think it was just getting good.
Probably an item.
See the building.
I think that's the right number.
Welcome to the committee, I think.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We are running into a...
technical difficulties. I think that Assistant Commissioner Kudelka has a very good song and dance he'd like to do.
Yes.
Mr. Chair and committee members, I didn't believe the presentations is in your folders. We'd be happy to start it. That helps.
Yeah. Begin, please. Identify yourself for the record. Welcome.
Chair and committee members, my name is Kirk Kudelka. I'm Assistant Commissioner with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, and I have with me with MPCA my colleague.
Greta Gothier, Legislative Director of Minnesota Pollution Control Agency.
In addition, you'll see we have a number of community leaders from the two communities that we'll be talking about today. And I know they will be addressing and adding on to our presentation. But I want to make sure to recognize both the city of Andover and Burnsville for being here today. Thank you for the opportunity here to present our capital bonding request for two of our projects. And just a quick reminder, the first slide is our mission. It's working to protect and improve the environment and human health. And that's what we're here today to talk about. Our mission really can be achieved in three ways, and that's in dealing with pollution is one, prevent it, two, manage it, and three, clean it up. And as we go down that cycle towards the cleaning up, it becomes much more expensive. And unfortunately, many times the impacts to the environment and human health are already being felt. And that's what we're going to talk about, two projects that have unfortunately already come to that situation where we are now in the business of cleaning up the sites. Overall, the MPCA's capital budget request, we have three projects, WDE landfill under the closed landfill program in Andover for $6 million, the start of the freeway landfill in Burnsville for just under $53 million for phase one, and then also a capital systems recycling infrastructure statewide grant program for organics. My understanding is today we're going to focus on the first two items, and I'll start with a little history on the closed landfill program. It was created in 1994 as an alternative to Superfund. Just a little bit of history. Superfund works very well when we have one or two responsible parties, and then the agency, whether it's EPA or MPCA, works with those responsible parties to do the cleanup and address human health and the environment. Landfills are a much different situation. It's not just one or two responsible parties that are landfill owners. We're also now looking at the haulers that brought waste there, all the companies and individuals that brought waste there. And as we go through the Superfund process, this really ties up the system, where we end up spending a lot of time working on administrative and legal arguments on who should clean it up and who's paying what portion of the cleanup. And unfortunately, as a state, we were not getting anywhere, which is why the legislature created this remarkable program, the Closed Landfill Program. It is the envy of every other state as we talk to our colleagues and how we are actually able to address landfills and not have these drag on forever. And so that is something that we should be very proud of and thank the legislature for creating this program. Today we have 109 landfills in the program that the state of Minnesota is the caretaker of. We have five more that are eligible, that are in various stages of working their way into the program. How we do our work really is based on risk. And we base that on the monitoring data that we have, looking at the amount of hazardous materials at the locations, groundwater monitoring on the outside of the facilities and off-sites, looking at methane, looking at the concentration of the population around it to determine risk scores. And we do this to prioritize our work, and because we have limited dollars, to really put it where we can get the biggest need and have the most chance for improvements. And the two sites that we're talking about today have annually flip-flopped at number one, WDE and Freeway Landfill. They both are at a score of about 74,000 points. And just to give you an understanding, number three is at 38,000 points. So we're talking about nearly double the risk score of these two sites compared to the other ones within our program, which is why they're part of our bonding program, our proposal. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to my colleague, real quick, Greta Gauthier, just talk about the first project.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I'll direct members to a handout we have on this. This is the WDE landfill that's located in Andover, Minnesota.
Ms. Gauthier, would you identify yourself, please?
Certainly, Mr. Chairman. Greta Gauthier, Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. So this is a landfill that's located smack in the middle of Andover, Minnesota. It consists of a landfill of regular metropolitan solid or garbage that we throw away. And then there's an additional hazardous waste pit in this landfill. And this pit is on the map you see up here in the little red circle. And that pit was where, between 1972 and 1974, 6,600 barrels of waste were buried. And that waste consisted of PCBs, paint solvents, heavy metals, other paint wastes, and volatile organic compounds. Today we have four. If you look at the back of the handout, there is a timetable of what has happened at this site since it started in 1962. We have four systems running at this site to control contamination: two air systems to deal with the methane, and two water systems to pump and treat water, groundwater. In 2016 and 2017, we received a total of $12 million, $650,000 in general fund in 16, and the remainder in bonding last year. And that was what we had anticipated our costs would be to clean up this hazardous waste pit and move that material out of Minnesota. Unfortunately, this year in September, when we got on the site and started doing some more sampling and excavating, looking around, we found out that the contamination, the existing hazardous waste, was worse than we thought. So there was a liner put in underneath this pit back in the 70s, but it consisted of asphalt and clay, and we got into the site and found out that the liner is completely dissolved. We thought it perhaps was degraded, but still holding together somewhat, but it is completely dissolved. And so now, if you look at this cutaway of the pit, so it's a side view, the soil under the pit is contaminated. It's about 20 feet thick going down to the first aquifer, and that soil is completely saturated with hazardous waste, so we have to treat it as hazardous waste. Now that means that instead of taking out the brown area there that says hazardous waste pit, we also are going to need to remove the soil under the pit. We are still testing up around the sides of the pit to see if we need to remove that too. And then the groundwater, the first aquifer there underneath is contaminated, and we'll have to address that as well. And that is why we are looking for an additional $6 million in bonding. In 2018, this was in the governor's request. We, as I said, we have some additional sampling underway, but there's a lot more that we will be doing. We had a community meeting this fall. It was very well, highly attended. The neighbors are very interested in the cleanup plans, and we have maintained a two-way communication ongoing with the city, the county public health, and the agency, as well as residents. Right now, Mr. Chairman, if we were able to get this additional $6 million, we would be able to do the cleanup as things now stand in the winter of 2018-19.
Thank you. And Ms. Gauthier, just so that the people and members understand, last year we did appropriate $12 million to clean up this site. And what you are telling us is that it was worse than you thought, and the $12 million did not do the job completely. And so you are asking for another $6 million so that we can finish, you can finish the job. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, that is exactly right. Thank you.
And where does the, once you have the soil, where is it, what state do you send it to?
Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In Minnesota, we do not have a facility to handle this level of hazardous waste. The closest one is in Illinois. There's also one in Texas, and there are a few out west.
Nothing in Wisconsin?
No, I'm so sorry, Mr. Chairman. At these facilities, they would incinerate it, and then they would store the ash permanently in appropriate protective cells.
Okay, thank you. Questions? Do we have more testifiers?
Mr. Chairman, we would like to go on and talk about the other landfill quickly.
Let's do. We'll do questions on this one, or
we can do whatever you want.
There was a sock.
This one.
Okay, go.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The question is getting to the issue of burn rate for the whole project of the money and assets that you're bringing to bear. How effective and or how fast are you using current money to move toward the finish? And then am I conceptualizing right that the additional funds are to finish in that we are progressing, or is it that more assets will help you do it faster in time? What's the relationship of risk to money to time?
Commissioner Gadelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, thank you for the question. We right now are doing the investigation. We would not open up this pit unless we had all the dollars secured, because we want to make sure we do go in there once and do it right. Okay. Otherwise, we run the risk of leaving it open.
Okay, thank you. Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Gauthier, could you just talk a little bit about the groundwater contamination? Is it containable? Is it? Can you deal with it? I mean, in the immediate area, can it be dealt with? Or, you know, how far does it go, spread?
Ms. Gauthier.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If it's all right with you, I'll have Commissioner Gadelka talk about that.
Commissioner Gadelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, the good news is that the drinking water wells for the city are in a deeper aquifer and further away, so in a non-contaminated aquifer. So we're good there. The private wells in the area typically are also in a deeper aquifer. However, there are five that we know of in this area that we have already sampled one. It's showing clear. The good news is that we also have monitoring wells all the way around the landfill to make sure that it isn't moving into neighborhoods or into other wells. So we're confident we've got that taken care of. The long-term concern is that as this site continues, the systems we have are capable of taking care of it now, but they do need periodic updating. They do break down, and the long-term solution really here is to just remove it from the location, and we believe that would make sure lower any potential risk in the future from the hazardous waste location and also allow us to shut down some of those systems and have a more cost-effective solution for the site.
Thank you.
Representative Uglum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I noticed the Mayor of Andover is here. My questions are for the Madam Mayor.
Hi, I'm Andover Mayor Julie Trude. I'd welcome your question.
Ms. Trude,
Representative Uglum.
I understand that in the surrounding area and things, it's bordered by housing, single-family homes and all of that. I've driven by it numerous times. And is there a school that's in a proximity to this landfill, too?
Ms.
Actually,
Trude.
There are multiple schools. There are over 5,000. I believe it's 5,500 students are attending school within a short distance of this closed landfill every day. So the Andover High School is immediately west. Andover Elementary is about one block to the north. And then Andover, the Oakview Middle School is a little further, about a mile. But then there's also a number of daycares within a mile and a half radius. And I would say within 2 miles, 50% of our population, 15,000 residents, would live within 2 miles of this landfill. And our community population is about 33,000. We're the third largest city in Anoka County.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Uglum.
Yeah, just to follow up. Yeah, I guess I was asking a bit of a leading question because I've been Andover many times, but it indicates the seriousness of the situation here in Andover and the proximity of so many people. This thing has been neglected for a very, very long time. Thank you.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's intriguing to hear about a problem that we've started resolving and then found out it was bigger than we thought. Where else is that? What else could that be? Got a problem. Open it up. Bigger problem than we thought. We need the money to finish the job, to clean up the mess.
May I respond to that?
Well, I'll give you a license to do that.
Thank you, Ms. Chairman. I'm in government, too, and I know in a project where you're building a building, it's a little easier to see what you're getting into, and you can take bids, and you know what you're going to have when you're done. When you dig a hole into muck that's been brewing for about 30 years, you're not so sure what you're going to find. It's a little bit like when you begin the home improvement project and you pull out the dishwasher and it leads to five more projects. This project exemplifies that type of project. You start digging the hole. We had the soil borings, and I think Chair Erdahl saw some of those borings a year ago, and it was frightening, the color of the soils. We didn't have enough money to poke around any more than those initial borings, and the initial belief was everything was contained within a liner. Now that the funds for further investigation as the project is getting prepared for bid, the depth is deeper, and this is one of these projects where you have to shore up the sides and you have to go down. They're going to have hazmat suits. And my resident expert who works in this field has told me that the cost per square foot of this type of waste is about $1,000 a cubic foot. It's very costly, so the more waste that we find under this pit. But his hopeful message to me was, Mayor, if we can get down to that water table and clear out the bad dirt that's there holding the contaminants, the water will start to purify itself over the years coming up. And so I hope all of us can feel hopeful, because that was the message that all of these fine people gave to my residents who packed City Hall and calmly and passionately inquired, is this a safe place to raise my children? Is my water at risk? Is the city water at risk? And everybody was very polite and reasonable, which I love about my residents. We don't get angry public hearings. We're pretty fortunate that way. But they want to know the facts. And the facts are, it's a problem. We can deal with it. If we deal with it in the right way, we don't want to go back. They don't want you to go back. These people don't want to go back. So they want me to come back and say, the state recognizes that we want to go in there once and be done. So thank you,
Mayor Trude. Representative Hansen, I think one of the lessons here is that with this, as well as other things in government, sometimes you just don't know how deep the bad dirt is. Representative Hansen.
And Mr. Chair, and I agree that we have to fix the problem once you dig in there. You may not know how deep the dirt is or how bad the technology is, but you've got to finish the job, particularly when you've already opened up the hole. So I think there's a lesson here for us that we need to get the job done when we do these things. And I'm fully supportive of funding capital projects like this to solve the problem, just like I'm fully supportive of providing the needed money for technology to finish the job, to get the job done with Minlarge as well.
Thank you, Representative Hansen. I didn't realize that that's what you were hinting at. Representative Dean?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I
I wasn't here at the beginning of your testimony, but I'm curious, what's happening to the site then after? Are we restoring it to a certain level for development, or is it going to be a permanently a hazard zone where no other future uses could be used? Is there a capping that's going to happen so that, you know, I mean, I notice there's ball fields right next to it. So I guess I'm not only thinking about what does this cleanup look like, what does this look like afterwards as well?
Mr. Gadelka, Commissioner?
Mr. Chair and committee members, the hazardous waste pit, when it's emptied, will be filled in with other waste from the location and recapped to repair the cap on top to reduce any amount of water going into the landfill. However, the rest of the outline there in the orange will remain. It will remain a closed landfill, which will be under state oversight, and there is not opportunities for development because of the landfill there. An old landfill like this would be a very difficult place, if possible at all, to build on because of not only the contamination, but landfill settle, and any structures would deteriorate over time on top of it. Mr. Chair and committee members, regarding the ball fields, they will stay in place. We will continue to have after the site, after the work here, monitoring during the work, and after the work, the monitoring wells and some of the other systems will stay in place to also protect the homes and residents and the ball fields around the site after we're done with the hazardous waste pit. There will still be that landfill that will still have a lot of attention to make sure that we're protecting human health and the environment.
Okay. Thank you. And I think that the mood of the committee is to take a very, very serious look at this and try to resolve the problem. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You ready for part two?
Mr. Chair, if you'd like, I can move on to the next one, or I don't know if you'd like to take the local leaders, any comments for them first, and we'll move on to the next thing?
If there are other comments on the Andover site, we'll take them now and then move to the next one. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just want to thank the committee for their support on this project. It's really important to our community. And the community is very focused on this project and getting it done. And so, unfortunately, we're back at the table asking for more humbly because the damage is deeper than we thought. So I want to thank you again for taking an interest in this project.
Thank you, Representative Scott. Your advocacy for this has been helpful to us.
Chairman, if I might add, Mayor Julie Trout, I think we covered all my points with the questions. I appreciate the time today. I appreciate the funding last year. Because of the funding last year, they were able to get the studies going, and I think it'll be a more efficient project. And the original plan was to get the project going as soon as it could happen. And after a little discussion in our community, we did not want to open a landfill during baseball season. We want to wait till the weather is cold and the ground is cold and people have their windows closed. And so I appreciate the funding last year. It did help us make progress to the point that we know they're going to get it done. And I was told once they open the landfill, it's 90 days, close it up, they're done. So there's a lot of time and money spent on the plans and engineering with the soil borings. And my community, overall, the mood was very positive. They were respectful of the people that were there. I appreciate the commissioner sending all of his top-level people who could answer any question that came up. Our county health department has been very supportive of testing the wells. There are people who have wells they are relying on within a half mile of this site that was not researched in the past. So just the fact we started looking at the project, some people switched to city water. Some people are getting their wells evaluated and thinking about change. So there are some things that happened because of the funding last year, and now I feel confident with the studies that we'll be able to move ahead, and I can go back and assure my public it's a safe place to live, the community is a good place to live, and we do not have concerns about our city wells. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Mayor.
Mr. Chair and committee members, the second project on our list is the freeway landfill and dump. For those that may remember, there was legislation on a policy angle on freeway last year, and the legislature helped us overcome a roadblock in terms of how to handle the site and move it forward administratively. And we are moving forward with that effort. We have submitted a plan, report to the legislature that outlines how the what activities we've been doing since then, including how the language that was passed last year will help us get to our end goal. For those that have not heard about Freeway Landfill, it is located in the city of Burnsville, right next to 35 as you're coming over the Minnesota River. It is two sites that we're looking at. One is Freeway Dump on the east side of the highway, and the other is Freeway Landfill on the west side of the highway. Both unlined facilities. The Freeway Landfill itself is the largest landfill that's eligible for our closed landfill program. Our concern is that Kramer Quarry that you'll see on the map has altered hydrology there. The good news is it is preventing the groundwater from going through the landfill at this time. However, the bad news is Kramer's quarries will not be there forever. And when it does, the groundwater will flow from the southern part of the community north through the landfill, through the waste, and into the river, and also Kramer Quarry will become a lake. And our concern is, with our modeling, with our consultants, have shown numerous metals and other chemicals would be over Department of Health values. This is of important concern not only to the Minnesota River, but to Kramer Quarry, because that's the location of the city of Burnsville and Savage's drinking water. In addition, to the bottom of the map, off the map, south of Freeway Dump, is also their secondary well field. So we're looking at two potential threats to the community's drinking water sources once Kramer Quarry stops pumping. And at this time, we do not have a date on when specifically that will happen, but we do know that they cannot go on forever. This is a project that will take about 5 years for construction. The idea is we're looking at it right now. We're doing some more investigation on the dump side because we have not been able to get on that property. That work will start with the contractors and the big equipment going in later this month to do additional work. But we understand that we will need to put the material on the landfill at least on a lined facility at that location, which is where the cost is quite large. We're looking at a total project cost of an estimated of $90 million. That is, again, the estimate, because the one component for Freeway Dump, we have not been able to get on that property, so we do not know if we can handle it on site or have to take it over to the landfill side and put it onto a liner there with the materials from the landfill. We have tried to break this down into a number of phases for funding, because we understand there are a lot of very good projects that have come to the legislature for their support. And so what we would be looking for this year is $52.763 million to start the first 2 years of the construction of this project. We would then anticipate coming back in 2020 for the bonding bill to request the remaining $34 million for this project. With that, Mr. Chair and members, I do have community leaders also here for this project. If you'd like to hear from them before, I'd be more than willing to answer questions afterwards.
Representative Constantine, do you want them to finish, or do you want to ask your question now?
I'd like to ask it now.
Well, then you can.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Ahead. Why can't you get on site?
Commissioner Gadelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, previously on the dump side, we were not granted access by the private landowner. We have since secured an access agreement at the end of last year, and we have already done markings on where we will be doing the borings and also some trenches and others to do work, but that's that will drive the determination of the cost. So previously we have not had access. We do now for this month to move ahead.
Representative Constantine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the guy that owns it, the guy that has the problem, has been denying you access.
Commissioner Gadelka?
Mr. Chair and committee members, correct.
That's amazing. It's going to cost the state $90 million, and this guy's denying you access.
Commissioner Gadelka?
Mr. Chair and committee members, we have worked a number of years with our partners in the city and county to try to find a resolution that could have a cleanup of this much earlier. The legislation last year allows for this landfill to be taken care of if there is not cooperation to make sure that we are there to be able to protect the drinking waters for the city of Burnsville and Savage. And we will continue to work to try to get cooperation as we have now for this phase. But if we do not get that cooperation, the legislature has afforded us the ability to do the cleanup without the access.
Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is this guy kicking in any money, or is he just walking away from the problem?
Commissioner Kudelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, under the closed landfill program, all potential responsible parties, landfill owners, but also those haulers who brought waste here, the businesses that may have sent waste there, the state has taken on that responsibility. The landfills are a societal problem, and is why we created the closed landfill program to take care of it. So he's being treated like any other landfill owner or any other responsible party for the site. It is confusing on why he would not want to see the property be cleaned up. We've had, as I mentioned, with our city and county partners, conversations with him, but they would have to ask him specifically on why he does not.
That's amazing. I guess I have no more questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Constantine. Representative Poston.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's a $90 million cleanup project, and I don't know anything about landfill cleanup. Could you just draw us a picture of what that looks like, how you clean it up, where that $90 million is spent?
Commissioner Kudelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, if you look at the map there, the freeway landfill, what we would do is basically start on the southern part there, dig up the waste, put it on another portion of the landfill, build a liner, bring back the waste onto the liner, and then do that like a loaf of bread as we move north, continually building the liners and cells and closing them as we go to make sure that the waste is on a line system. The cost there is touching all the material multiple times, the underlying systems that need to be put in. Not only would we be building a liner, we would be building a cap on top afterwards to protect it from rainwater. We would create a leachate control management system, so the water that's in there that we can take care of appropriately. In addition, because of the large amount of methane created by the location, we would either vent or have an active gas system where we would flare it to burn it so that we didn't create other environmental problems.
Thank you, Representative Uglum.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Poston did cover my question, so appreciate it.
Representative Dean is next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner. This liner won't dissolve 30, 40 years like the last project that we just looked at.
Commissioner Kudelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, correct. This is a different design. That was a very rudimentary design of, much like you build a parking lot, this would be a number of layers of materials along with a synthetic liner that would go underneath to make sure that we would not have that problem.
Representative Dean.
And that the new design has stood the test of time in other sites, and we can be assured that it's actually going to do what the engineers have designed it to do.
Commissioner Kudelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, this is the same system we use for other landfills, which is required across the nation and in the states. It is the technology that we know will stand many years into the future. And that's the goal, is to make sure that we take care of this landfill in the long term.
Representative Dean.
So I think that this would be a time to interject that we as a society need to do a much, much better job of reducing our waste.
Representative Carlson.
The discussion about the cost of the cleanup, who in the end owns this land then?
Commissioner Kudelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, under the closed landfill program, the landfill owner is allowed to continue on ownership of the property. There are some situations where they do continue on the ownership, but most cases it's turned over to the state or it's a local unit of government that has control of it because of the restrictions placed on the property that prevent other types of construction. For instance, on the the facility, line facility itself, you could not build on it. In addition, the use of bonding dollars on any parcel of this property would tie it up for over 30 years of any private use for the facility, so that the landowner would not be able to privately develop it if bonding dollars are used on those portions.
Well, Mr. Representative Carl, Chairman, just so I'm clear, then the forgetting the timeline for a moment, but when the state expends $92 million for the cleanup, the current landowner will continue to own the property? Is that what I'm hearing? Now, you're saying it would be of limited use, obviously, but he would continue to own what appears to be, as I look at the map here and the freeway and so on, some pretty prime property for somebody someday.
Commissioner Gadelka.
Mr. Chair, that is correct. Under the closed landfill program, he does have that option to continue the ownership.
And, Mr. Chairman, what would be the potential use of that land then short term? Once it's cleaned up, you said that there'd be some limited development. Would it just have to sit idle, or would there be some potential use for this landowner after we've expended on his benefit and society's benefit $92 million?
Commissioner Gadelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, nearly all freeway landfill will become the lined facility, so there will not be any allowed use on it. We will restrict any access to it because of those systems I talked about earlier, the venting, flares, leachate collection systems. There is the potential along the eastern portion along the highway there that some of the property could be developable. However, it would be a large hole, because the waste is down to bedrock. We would remove the waste, but we would not fill the hole. So before anyone could develop it, they would need to fill in the property because of other regulations dealing with flood areas and the like. So that has the possibility. However, there would likely be restrictions on it, ranging from institutional controls, preventing wells from being placed in the area, and other things depending on what we find in our further investigation and once we have the landfill opened up.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'll stop other than to say that I think we have to be cautious after we spend that kind of money cleaning it up, that the owner, wherever it would be on the property, doesn't end up with a windfall at state expense. And I'm not arguing that we don't need to clean it up. I think that's rather obvious with what you've described. But when you have a landowner that's been less than cooperative and we spend that kind of money and clean it up, and then there would be a potential for some development, you said, and then maybe some 30 years out, 30 years from now, either the owner or some of the owner's heirs would have a prime piece of property if it becomes usable again in the future, in 27 acres in that area. Would have some huge potential value at some point. So I hope that you're on top of that and make sure that there isn't a windfall for an owner, especially one that's been uncooperative.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, to answer the stunned looks on most people's faces here, this is an extraordinary project, an extraordinary incident. It's probably good for two or three graduate degree theses about what happens. I mean, this is a 20, 30, 40-year problem that we, as a legislature last year, did an extraordinary bill to deal with extraordinary problems because the landowner did not enter voluntarily into the closed landfill program, unlike all the other landfills. So it was having to go to the EPA to seek people who had dumped in there 20 and 30 and 40 years ago. So it's extremely extraordinary. And to Representative Carlson's question, and I have a question for Ms. Dyson, two points of the issues here. On what can be done with bondable land, kind of on the question with Representative Carlson, if it is public ownership of that land, can it be developed? It's my understanding that the county and the city want to use cash so that they can, there's the develop, if there was general dollars used, what can be done with bondable versus cash? And then secondly, in terms of what can be done in terms of phasing an appropriation, so could we do an FY19 appropriation and an FY20 appropriation in this bill? Is that doable? Is there precedent for even a bill that we would pass this year? Can we do appropriations for 2 years in that bill? That's the question.
Ms. Dyson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Henson, with regard to what can be, how can state bond finance property be used, I think the Commissioner Kudelka referred to that there are restrictions on that, and the he mentioned 30 years. I think, as I don't know the program that well, but I'm assuming that if it's staying in private ownership, there is a permanent easement or an easement that is imposed on this that gives the state the control over this, because state bond funds are not used for private property otherwise. So there has to be a public ownership element. And the length of that, and I'm trying to remember how it's phrased, but under the commissioner's order related to this, I think it's 125% of the useful life of the improvements paid for, but the commissioner may have some more to add to this. But I want to just finish the second question you have. I'll let the commissioner talk about the other part. But you asked about multi-year appropriations of bond funds. There's really only a commitment if the authorization is made this year. There can be sort of a statement of intent to appropriate in another year, but there would have to be in the bill enacted this year the actual authorization and appropriation, and then you can put in staging. And in 1994, the original closed landfill cleanup program, I believe, had that staging and then got tripped up in later years by the enactment of the cancellation statute that suddenly started canceling appropriations that and authorization that had been made. But it's only sort of a statement of intent to otherwise. So I'll leave it at that.
Thank you, Ms. Dyson. Commissioner Kudelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, we have in other cases with private owned properties that they didn't want to turn over to the state when they entered into a binding agreement with the state. We secure interest in the property at enough, whether it's easements or other types of title controls, so that we have that connection to allow for public dollars to be used, include bonding. In terms of number of years, our talking to MMB, it is 37.5 years would be the number of years that would prevent private development, so over 30 years.
Thank you. Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just out of curiosity, when was the last time they dumped garbage in this landfill?
Commissioner Kudelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, in the dump in 1971 and in the landfill they moved over to 1990.
Thank you.
Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to follow up on Representative Hansen's question, I heard Representative Hansen say they want cash. I had not been aware of that. Now, you were answering, Ms. Dyson, I think, about bond funding. But if it were cash, then don't different rules prevail? Then we could perhaps appropriate over a number of years. With bond funding, you couldn't. You'd have to authorize the entire amount at the beginning.
Ms. Dyson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hausman, the appropriation can be made, but a later legislature could cancel it. I mean, appropriating in out years has happened, but it's not a guarantee that the money wouldn't be canceled.
Mr. Chair, and I was not thinking you'd authorize all of the cash now, but you would authorize a portion, and then, you know, over time, you'd continue to authorize cash, but it wouldn't accrue to the bottom line in this year. You'd break it up over a number of years. appropriation of cash, so it's nothing. There's nothing there to cancel.
Mr. Lee?
Mr. Chair and Representative Hausman, so in terms of appropriating into the biennium beyond this, the appropriations cancel at the end of fiscal year 19 for the current biennium. So you could make the appropriation of the total amount and have it available till expended, but I don't think a legislature in the current year could appropriate for calendar year. I'm not sure if I'm answering your question.
No, Mr. Chair, what I'm saying is this year we would appropriate $25 million cash, $20 or $25 million cash. Next year, we'd appropriate $20, $25 million in cash. That's that we wouldn't appropriate in advance. We would only do an amount that might be spent this year in cash.
Head nodding doesn't register.
Mr. Lee and Representative Hausman, certainly the legislature could appropriate cash this year and appropriate cash another year. It just takes that future legislature to do the appropriation.
Thank you. Do you have some other comments from the testifiers? We have other testifiers.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Heather Johnston, the Burnsville City Manager. Mayor Kaut sends her regards. She's presiding over a council meeting here in less than an hour, so she apologizes for not being here. Thank you for taking the time to take testimony on this important bill. I also want to thank Representatives Peterson and Mason and Christensen for their support on this legislation, as well as all of your support on passing House File 2212 last year. I understand that you all have received a copy of the letter of support we sent to the governor last fall, so I'll only highlight a few points. As you've heard, the freeway landfill is located in Burnsville, but the benefits of its closure reach far beyond its borders. More than 180 entities were initially contacted by the EPA as potentially responsible parties for the substantial cleanup costs and litigation associated with this landfill. Those numbers were expected to increase prior to the legislation where the state took over the responsibility for this. This landfill, as you've heard, is located near the Minnesota River above the Prairie du Chien Aquifer, next to the Minnesota Valley Wildlife Refuge on a site that historically had included wetlands. The landfill remains improperly mitigated today, and we believe the importance of cleaning it up cannot be understated. As you've heard, millions of gallons of water are pumped daily from the adjacent quarry. Both the cities of Savage and Burnsville receive their drinking water from this source, and protecting the drinking water is our top priority. When quarry operations cease, this will become a 340-acre lake, which can remain pristine only if the landfill is remediated. We do, as you've just heard, the City of Burnsville supports a portion of the cleanup being funded with general fund dollars. There are significant redevelopment opportunities at this location after remediation, which would increase the tax value of the property to the benefit of the state, county, and city taxpayers. The city projects the potential tax value to be about $49 million, which will benefit the region through an expanded tax base, job creation, and then increased revenues, including sales income and business taxes. We understand this is a very large request. However, these local and regional benefits cannot be realized until the landfill is properly closed, cleaned up, and available for redevelopment, protecting the drinking water. We also expect the cost of this remediation will only grow with the passage of time. So timely remediation of this site is critically important to the security of the Minnesota River and the Prairie du Chien Jordan Aquifer. Thank you so much for your time and for your consideration, and I stand for any questions you might have.
Thank you, Ms. Johnston. Questions of her? Representative Carlson.
You heard my questions about redevelopment and what have you, and you just made comments about the potential redevelopment. Could you give us a quick synopsis of what you mean by the redevelopment? Is it right on the Superfund site, or are you talking about development in close proximity, and does the current owner benefit from that redevelopment once this is cleaned up in the eyes of the city?
Ms. Johnston.
Mr. Chair, Representative Carlson, this property is part of a larger redevelopment area called the Minnesota River Quadrant in the city of Burnsville. So as you heard Commissioner Kadelka mention, that if the landfill is remediated, that part that is the new landfill, if you will not really have any redevelopment potential. the big hole that he referred to that would need to be filled with dirt would have some redevelopment potential. We currently, there are other areas that need to be cleaned up, and we've been working at cleaning up areas in the vicinity of the landfill as well. And so it's that piece of property that would have to have the dirt brought in and filled up in order to have development potential.
Mr. Chairman, I don't represent any Maple Grove, but my district goes up to Maple Grove, and I go up that way quite a bit, and there is mining operations in Maple Grove, and maybe as we speak, big holes are being filled in for future economic development, and I'm talking about major holes. I don't know how big this one will be out there in Burnsville, but it looks to me like there's somebody that could benefit, at least on the peripheral. And I don't know if the owner then of the landfill owns the property on the peripheral that would be redeveloped or not. But I suspect once that landfill issue is solved, and I don't think anybody's arguing against solving it. I mean, I'm certainly not. But I don't want to see somebody that is benefiting of by state expense having a windfall, like I was saying earlier, if they happen to be the ones that own the land around it that's going to have all that multi-millions of dollars of development that you were talking about. But I'll stop there. If you want to comment, fine. Otherwise, we can move on.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Carlson, the properties on the peripheral, if you will, that I was referring to, those have different ownership. However, the hole that would need to be filled in would be, as I understand it, could potentially be owned by the current owner of the landfill.
Thank you.
Representative Sock, and then we need to move along.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And real quickly, I suspect you have, and just for my benefit, have you pursued all avenues, whether adverse or whatever, to change the ownership and get control of the property?
Commissioner Kudelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, the closed landfill program up to last year was a voluntary program, so the landowner would have had to sign a buy-in agreement. We've tried many years to negotiate an agreement with him to allow for his transfer station, that circle you see there, to continue to operate during the construction into the future, because our understanding there is not waste underneath that facility, although we're double-checking. And those went to no luck. Last year, we, with the legislature's help, now have the ability to use other methods, going to the court or ultimately eminent domain, if it's called upon, for the state to be able to get access to the property to be able to do the work. And so we now have a full range of options where we didn't previously. At the end of that last legislative session, it did require for us to try one more time to find a voluntary approach, and we approached him one more time with a binding agreement, an example for him to sign or offer changes to, and during that 60-day window, we were unsuccessful. So we are now moving forward with the non-voluntary options, although still asking always permission and to be able to get on property if needed. If not, go to court where needed.
Thank you.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just want to thank you, members, for your support on the freeway landfill project, which I do have a thesis completed, so I feel prepared with my 8-inch thick file that I've accumulated last year. But I think that we understand that this is a societal issue, and it is something that the state has taken on the liability, and that is why we're here today asking for your support. At the end of the day, this project does need to be cleaned up, and quite frankly, the government's the only one that's going to be able to do it. So appreciate your support. Thank you so much for the wonderful testimony that we've had so far, and we will continue to work with the owner in finding an amicable solution moving forward as well.
Thank you, Representative Peterson. Representative Mason.
Members, thank you very much for your attention. I think it's pretty apparent that this is a huge public safety issue. So we really would appreciate your support. The other part that we talked about, using money instead of bonding, I think is something that the city both would prefer having the money just to make sure that there's options available afterwards. And the MPCA said that they are neutral on that, so I think that's a really good step as well. But again, thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Mason. I know there are a couple other questions, but I really would like to move on to Mr. Kerr so we do get him today. But there may be other opportunities for these questions to be asked, and we'll see to that.
As long as you owe me.
I always do.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Kerr, come on down.
You feel like you made your point?
Well, we shouldn't do that number one until we take it with eminent domain.
That's what we're doing. That's just that's uncooperative. I might have $1 million.
Welcome to the committee. Introduce yourself, please, and begin your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Mr. Chair, thank you for the opportunity to do the presentation today. We're going to try to go this way. We do have copies of the briefing, I think, in everybody's packets. There we go. But I will follow along here, and I will move with alacrity. I know everyone's a bit of a timeline. Thank you to the members who were able to make the bonding trip up and visit us at Camp Ripley in St. Cloud. St. Cloud was our representative facility. As you know, six projects in the governor's bonding bill this year.
You identify yourself, please.
I'm sorry, Don Kerr, the executive director of the Department of Military Affairs. Total request, $25.578 million, six projects, St. Cloud, Wadena, Brainerd, Grand Rapids, Rosemont, and Fergus Falls. Mr. Chair, this is what I'm going to cover today, a little bit of history, where our locations are, what our maintenance backlog is, what our strategy is for the longer term.
Mr. Kerr?
Yes, sir.
Just to be clear, readiness center is essentially an armory.
Another word for armory, Mr. Chair.
That's what I thought. Thank you.
Yeah, harder to spell, but same thing. sir, we do have facilities around the state. We do think our statewide presence is very important, and the reason I want to talk about that is at the very end of the presentation, I've got a little overview of a longer-range strategy that we were forced to look at from the national level. The U.S. Senate was concerned about the large number of requests they had for replacement facilities, and so they directed a study to go around the nation to identify where we're at, and they were really trying to drive us down to a smaller number of facilities. We did take a hard look at this and spent a large amount of staff time looking at it and do feel that we probably have too many armories right now based on the demographics of Minnesota, the improvement in the communication and transportation infrastructure in Minnesota. So we are on a glide path to divest of some of our facilities and consolidate others. We think that that, over the long term, will reduce our maintenance burden for those facilities. So we are looking at this in more than one way. This isn't just a never-ending, we're coming back to the legislature for more money, but we're looking at how we can be sustainable over the long term. However,
Mr.
I will Kerr, point
just,
out.
Just so you remember, Litchfield has just been very recently remodeled.
Yes, sir. Litchfield is not one that, that we're planning to divest of. Those are on the very last page. If you want to jump ahead to get mad at me now, feel free. But we do have a number of very old facilities. We have three facilities in our inventory that are 100 years old. We have a large number that were built in the 20s and 30s, and obviously a lot of things have changed since that time for requirements and other things. And so we are looking, whenever possible, to do a consolidation divestiture that makes sense for the long term. So, again, I'll talk about that longer-term plan. But we really got here in a number of different ways. We do feel that over many, many years, we were not efficient in advising the legislature of how our needs were changing for maintenance. We also started doing things like building larger armories to replace old armories. And that sounds really good, and it's very necessary because we have greater requirements, but larger armories need bigger roofs. Bigger roofs cost more money. And so when we replace a 50,000 square foot armory with a 125,000 square foot armory, we have higher maintenance costs over the long terms. We believe that we have corrected the structural deficiency in our budget through the legislature's action a couple of years ago, increasing our biennial appropriation from about 6.6 to about $10 million a year in maintenance. That will help stay ahead of the curve. However, we do have some pent-up demand, and we likely will still have to come back periodically to the legislature when we have a requirement to do a major renovation in one of our larger facilities. 41% of our facilities currently are rated poor or failing on the facility condition index rating. And at some point, we have had a restricted match in federal funding. That has not been a problem of late. We've actually been getting quite a bit of money from the federal government. In fact, our ability to come up with a state share has been our biggest challenge. I wanted to give you a little history. Prior to 2000, we cannot find any record that we made a capital improvement request to the legislature, but we did start doing it around 2000. There are three lines depicted on this chart. The blue one, which is the top line in all cases, is what we assessed our requirement to be. The green line is the level that the governor supported of our request, and the red line is the level that the legislature funded of our request. Predictably, there are some deltas between the bottom line and the top line, and we understand how that's going to go. But we also know that not funding a requirement doesn't make the requirement go away. It just pushes it down the road, unless we can divest of the facility. But we are showing that particularly since 2013, the level of funding on capital investment for the department has been kind of inadequate. So that brings us back to our maintenance backlog. And I am aware, and I'm sure you're aware, that all the agencies will come in with really big numbers here because we can count a lot of broken stuff. What's relevant, though, is the number of our facilities that really are in poor and fair condition and the amount of money that we have kind of slipped behind. Now, I will tell you right away that some of those facilities that are in the poor condition are probably scheduled for divestiture, so we would not ask you to bring all those up. Obviously, if we've already decided that we're going to walk away from something, we're not going to put any more money in it. So the number is a little bit false that way, and the worst thing you could do is give us $72 million because we'd never be able to come up with a federal share over short term, but we do think that we have a good strategy moving forward. Once again, our budget request, we started with this up front. Those are the six projects. And the other thing I think I need to say at this point, so we have 63 facilities that we're currently using. Three of those we're in the process of divesting of. Over the short term, we're going to be in 61. We're adding one as well. That's where the number is. Let's call it 60. If we have 60 facilities and we have a roof that fails after 25 to 30 years and a boiler that fails every 25 to 30 years, we need to be getting into two or three of these facilities every bonding cycle if we're going to stay ahead of the walls falling out. And so we started our program by looking primarily at trying to get two to three a bonding cycle so that we can get those done. We have a little pent-up demand right now, and so you see six on our list this year because we have to catch up for the last couple of years. However, we will see that diminish slightly if we can get these six funded and eventually start moving down as we get some of our older facilities replaced with newer facilities. I have included in your packets detail sheets of all of the armories. You'll see that many of them look very similar as far as what we intend to do because we're going to do the same things in most cases. We're going to replace the old inefficient windows. We're going to replace the old inefficient doors. We're going to replace the boilers that are wearing out. We're going to put new roofs on the facilities. We're going to tuck point them, and we're going to upgrade the mechanical systems in them. And we're going to try to do that in one fell swoop so there's less disruption to the unit rather than coming in and doing those projects individually. One that I do want to point out to you that's kind of significant to us is the biggest one on the list, and that's the Rosemont Readiness Center. Rosemont is one of the large buildings that we have, and we have a couple of things that are aligning. We probably could have waited maybe a couple of years before we went into Rosemont with a major project, but with the upcoming deployment of the 34th Division, we wanted to take advantage of the unit being basically out of that facility while they're overseas to get in and do a renovation. It just so happens that on the backside of that, if the Congress ever passes the budget, we have a $40 million facility, 100% federally funded. It has been approved. We're just waiting for the budget so we can let a contract to build that thing at Arden Hills, and our intent is to move the division into that building when they return. Unfortunately, since we're still under a continuing resolution, we haven't been able to let that contract, and we've now lost an entire construction season because of that. That's not your fault. It was your friends at the federal level, and I remind them of that every time I see them, and I hope you do too. We need them to pass a federal budget. But it's important to us to do this rather large project in Rosemont so that we can get that timing aligned so that we're not disrupting a bunch of units and we can kind of hit the natural breakpoint to do this renovation in Rosemont. I will then jump to this thing called the Readiness Center Transformation Master Plan. This was the congressional directive to go out and take a look at this across the nation on a common standard so that they had a better idea. The challenge is that we did this in 2014. and we came up with a wonderful plan at the national level that we basically decided that nationwide we needed $1 billion a year, and so far none of that has been forthcoming. So the federal match side of this thing is drifting into oblivion. However, we still have found the staff work to be useful because it's really helped focus us on where we need to have facilities, where we need to consolidate facilities, how we need to go about that, and that is on the last page, our current plan. Some question on the dates. A lot of this, the dates are dependent on federal funding, and as I stated, we have not been very successful. But for example, all the way up in the upper left-hand corner in the Crookston Thief River area, it is our intention to divest of the Thief River Armory, put an addition on the Crookston Armory because we have adequate land available there, and so they'll get an improved facility that will support two units. In Appleton and Madison, our intent there is to divest of both of those old facilities and build one new facility. In a perfect world, halfway between Appleton and Madison, but we have to work with the localities out there to determine how that works. If you think about how high school consolidation occurred 25 years ago, that's probably a pretty good model for what we're looking at in some of those areas where the demographics aren't what they were in 1929. So with that, Mr. Chair, I would subject myself to questions.
Representative Detmer.
Yeah, Mr. Chair. Mr. Kerr, could you kind of briefly share with the committee here and your consolidation process? It's not just facilities, but it's the type of units that are utilizing and training at those facilities.
Mr. Kerr.
Mr. Chair, Representative Detmer, so we work very closely with the Army and with the Air Force to forecast what the changing needs of the Army and the Air Force are to ensure that the types of units that we have in Minnesota are consistent with what we need to support state active duty missions and what the Army and the Air Force need as they continue their relevance. And obviously those things change over time. So that's a bit of a trick, but we do also try to make sure that we put units into facilities that facilities can support. For example, M1 tanks are really wide. We have to make sure that if we're going to station tank units, we have to put them in relatively new facilities that have wide garage doors. It's really expensive to put in a wider garage door in a brick building. We know this from experience, unfortunately. The good news is when units are displaced like that, most of those are 100% federal renovations, so we try to find opportunities to let the feds pay for stuff every turn we possibly can.
Mr. Kerr, looking at the circle around Litchfield and Wilmer, what does that mean?
Mr. Chair, that means that at some point, and I believe the date is on there projected in 2053, we do have an intention to consolidate with Litchfield and Wilmer, and you'll notice that we have, let's see what we have on there for coding.
You could put it in Grove City.
We intend right now to divest of Litchfield in 2053, Mr. Chair. That's our plan.
All right.
We'll come talk to you about that someday, though.
You'll be dead.
You got a park.
Lyndon will stand up and defend us on that one.
Let her go. Let her go.
Mr. Chair, you wouldn't want me to lie to you. I know that.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm trying to read the itty-bitty type with a red dot in West St. Paul.
Mm-hmm.
And if you could, because a few years ago we actually visited the West St. Paul, this committee visited the West St. Paul facility about getting dollars. And do I see 2024 there for investment?
Mr. Kirk.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, yeah, even worse news for you. We see no future in the current facility in West St. Paul, and we have decided we're not going to put any more money into it because it's landlocked, it does not have adequate parking, and we cannot be good neighbors there. And so it is our intention to divest in West St. Paul. We did try to work with the city to find an acceptable solution in West St. Paul to do a replacement facility and tried, in fact, to move that up on the federal plan, but we were unsuccessful working with the city to find an acceptable location. We would still be open to that type of negotiation, but it's very difficult to make changes to the federal plans once they get cast in concrete.
And just, Mr. Chair, part of the reason that the city was unable to play is they have no money because they are in debt, because they had to pick up the cost for a state highway. And they don't have any flexibility to put any money into anything else. So then they lose existing stuff like this. There are consequences for some of these actions.
Mr. Salk?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Tell me what divesting means. I mean, I get that you're closing it down and leaving, but how do you transfer ownership? Who gets it? And is it the property neutralized, or is that also part of the negotiations?
Mr. Kerr.
Mr. Chair, Representative Salk, it depends. The statute lays out what process we go through when we're going to move away from a property. And by law, we have to go in and first offer it to the county and then offer it to the city, and then we can offer it for sale to the general public. There are some circumstances where we will go to the city and the county to determine what their intent is. If they have an interest in the property, for example, we already know New Ulm is a facility that should be on the FIDEP, and the next time it comes out, to build an armory there. And the city of New Ulm has been very very forward with us that they want to buy the old armory. And so we're going to do everything we can to work with them. But we think there are some other circumstances where it might make more sense for us to do demolition on the armory so that we have a clean lot. So far we haven't done that, but that is something that we're looking at in the future, depending on the circumstances. But we do have some properties right now that we have moved units out of that we're in the process of divesting. Faribault, we have an extra facility in Faribault. It's actually a pretty nice one. That's currently on the market for sale. Roseville, same situation. We're in the process of selling the old Stillwater Armory to a private buyer, and we've successfully sold the Northfield Armory to a private buyer who has now developed that property, I understand, successfully in downtown Northfield. We've also moved Long Prairie is in the process of being sold to Minnesota Power. So there's a process that we go through. It's laid out in statute where we follow it rigorously because we think it's important to follow the law, and because that's part of the funding stream for the agency as well.
Well, Mr. Kerr, I also played basketball on the floor of the Litchfield Armory, and on my 104th birthday, I would like a piece of that floor. Rips of sock.
Just one small thing, then. I want to compliment the people that, I mean, I'm sure this is not the first time you had to close down places, and so there are certain elements that you try to roll in, but just from an old dumb farmer that grew up, it's apparent to me that there's are some also some important things that are included in the thinking. The closeness of these sites so that at least units and or members can easily get to wherever the new site will be, and then also the fact that it continues to be relatively balanced across the state, even though one site is closing and the other, there maintains a certain geographic balance. And I just want to say that I compliment you guys on helping communities keep close to an asset like this.
Thank you, Mr. Kerr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
We meet again tomorrow. And seeing no other business before us today, well, King, this case is closed.